The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, there's an Indian story about a king, a powerful king, who was crossing a river with his army and elephants and all their gear. And, you know, of course, you know, when the horses and the elephants go across the stream, the water got very agitated, you know, stirred up and muddy. And then, as this very short story goes, the king got thirsty, and you know, maybe because of all this traveling. And so he asked his attendants to get him some drinking water from the stream. But the water was so dirty and muddy. So it sounds like some kind of problem. But the king had this miraculous gem. And when this gem was put into the water, it had the power to clear the water and make it all the fragments of vegetation floated away, and it purified it, made it a fit for a king to drink. So this is one of the analogies in the suttas for this other kind of gem. And when this gem is put into the heart, said that the hindrances float away, the defilements disappear, and the mind itself becomes serene, pure, and luminous. So, it sounds pretty good, right? So this gem is the gem of faith. What's usually translated as the English word faith in Pali is sada. So this quality of the mind and the heart. Here in the West, the word faith can sometimes be a little bit problematic for people. It carries some baggage or some resonance from other traditions, perhaps. So it can kind of be a loaded word. I like the word faith, and I think faith has a real heart quality. Sometimes sada is translated as trust, which I think also works well. Trust or confidence or commitment. So the literal meaning of the word from the Pali means to place the heart upon, to rest the heart upon. You know, something that we give our heart to. The function of faith in this practice is faith is what launches us on the path. Sharon Salzberg calls faith trusting your own deepest experience. So I think of this faith as it kind of has an emotional resonance, it has a heart connection. In a way, I think it's very close to love. You know, it's something about this feeling of coming home. That's something that I think we can often feel when we sit, you know, this feeling of intimacy, this feeling of coming home. I have a baby at home. She's just turned one, so it's a toddler. I guess. And so I think about babies a lot and the relationship between parents and babies. And I think one of the reasons that, especially a newborn baby, there's something so moving about them is that they're utterly helpless. It's like, you know, they, you know, it's like all they can do is trust. And I mean, I didn't fully get that until I became a parent. And they're like, you know, we have to do everything. And even now, my daughter's walking, and but you know, there's some times when she'll get a little bit agitated, or she'll get a little bit upset, and she'll arch her head back and just like, you know, and just completely fall back. I guess trusting that we'll catch her, which we always do. She's got to learn at some point that that's kind of dangerous. But you know, so what I realized is that it seems like one of the most important jobs for parents and for caregivers, you know, helping the baby develop trust. Develop this feeling that the world is a safe place, that her needs will be met. And I think there can be a parallel process that happens in meditation. You know, some people talk about this practice as a kind of reparenting. You know, and often the work of the inner child is something that can come up for people in meditation retreats. You know, this sense of being the parent that you need, or that you needed. So that relationship in trust. And then I also think about the relationship between a student and a teacher. You know, especially in this tradition, in this practice, for that relationship to work, the student needs to have faith in the teacher. Have some kind of faith that the teacher has something to offer, and then the teacher has a kind of faith in the student. I practice some Japanese Zen, and in Japanese there's this word called deshi, and a deshi means a Zen teacher's students who are authorized to teach. So it's kind of like they're students who finish their training and they're independent teachers. And one day I asked my Zen teacher about his deshi, and, you know, just we were talking, and he said, and he has something like 20 deshi, which is quite a lot in Zen. And he said, well, some of them are doing things that I wouldn't do. But I trust each one of them completely. And I also think about this, the power of trust, the kind of transformational power of trust. You know, it's like when we trust someone, you know, you've probably had this experience, I'm sure, of being trusted to do something that you didn't think you could do. You know, maybe you didn't feel, maybe you felt you didn't deserve to be trusted, or you didn't have the confidence to do it. But something about, you know, you are trusted and you come up to it. You know, inspired by someone's trust, you know, we can rise up to meet different challenges. So this quality of faith and trust, you know, to have faith in someone, to have trust in someone, is an incredible gift that we give to them. You know, giving your heart placing your heart upon something, someone. And so for the practice, excuse me. Aspects of faith include courage, trust, confidence, and patience. When I think of this dimension of courage, it's for me, it's like being willing to sit and being willing to face our minds and our hearts can sometimes be an incredibly courageous act. You know, it can take a lot of courage to face an unedited version of ourselves. And then patience, you know. Sometimes practice is described, especially in the beginning years, as stumbling along in the dark. You know, so it's like this willingness to stumble and not know exactly what we're doing. And trust. To trust the Dharma more than we trust our thinking minds. You know, this is a really big shift. And then another quality is this kind of confidence that you know, that we can do this practice. It's something like confidence in our own ability to meet this moment. And then I also think of the quality of surrender. I've told this story before of my wife has had some meditation retreats, and a number of years ago she sat her first Vipassana retreat without me, you know, because we'd often do things together, and she did a Goenka retreat. And some of you might be familiar with the Goenka model, which is kind of this strict 10-day retreat, and every day there are very, you know, it's quite, there's no variation. It's like, you know, you do this on day one and you do this on day two. And so she went through the retreat and she had these really great experiences. And I was a little bit, I had a little Dharma envy. And I said, you know, this is your first retreat? And she said, yeah, you know, this happened. And I said, okay, so tell me exactly what you did. And she looked at me and she said, I followed the instructions. I said, oh, never occurred to me. you know, and something about like this quality of surrendering, taking in the teachings, taking in the instructions. I've heard that Upandita, who's one of the senior Vipassana teachers in Burma, often says that women make the best yogis. And I think the connection I drew from it is that Burma can kind of be a patriarchal society, and he's, you know, in his 90s, and I think he has this sense that women yogis really listen and really do what the teacher asks them to do, and see very good results from that. So how does this quality of faith arise? It's said that there are two conditions needed for faith to arise. One condition is the encounter with suffering. And the second condition is the encounter with the true teaching, with the true Dharma, the Dharma of liberation. And when these two conditions are present, a big shift can occur. It's like, you know, instead of it's like, you know, this is the way things are and this is the way they always have to be. You know, we can have this sense of seeing this is not the default. You know, this is suffering, and you know, we can intuit that there's some way to be free from it. There's some way to work with it, to understand it, to practice with it, and to be free from it. So it's faith in the path to liberation, faith in the possibility of liberation. So in traditional terms, the objects of faith are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. You know, so it's faith in the enlightenment of the Buddha, faith in the truth of the Dharma, the truth of the teachings, and the support of the Sangha, support of the community. Faith is compared to a hand that which we can use to reach out and grab the practice. It's also compared to a seed from which grows all the beautiful qualities of the heart and of the mind that are needed for liberation. And as I said earlier, it's compared to this gem. That when we establish this gem in the heart, you know, it has the power to clear our difficulties, to clear out the defilements and the hindrances, and allows the mind to become peaceful. There are a number of places where faith appears in the teachings. One is this teaching of the five faculties. These are skills and capacities that we develop through the practice. And they're faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And so faith is at the beginning. You know, faith is what propels us. Faith is what launches us on the path. And so without faith, none of us would be here. You know, none of us would ever walk in the door. That's how faith is understood. And so in this teaching of the five faculties, faith needs to be balanced with wisdom. You know, when there's not wisdom, the danger is that faith becomes a kind of blind faith. And with blind faith, there's a possibility of veering off course. So another place where faith is taught and is mentioned is in this sutta called the Upanisa Sutta, and this is called the teaching of transcendent dependent arising. So the key insight of the Buddha, you know, what the Buddha awakened to, is this principle of dependent arising. You know, this principle of conditionality. In the chain of dependent arising, the Buddha shows how we go from ignorance to suffering, you know, over and over again. It's this cycle. That's how we take birth, over and over again, from ignorance to suffering. So in the sutta, the Upanisa Sutta, this is applying dependent arising to the process of liberation. And in the sutta, the Buddha shows not only how we go from ignorance to suffering, but how we go from suffering to liberation. usually suffering conditions more ignorance, you know, which conditions birth and clinging and more suffering and then to ignorance and that cycle. But when this transcendent or liberative dependent arising comes into effect, suffering, rather than conditioning ignorance, suffering conditions faith. So faith becomes the bridge, the pivot point, which marks the shift onto this more transcendent path. So it's considered that faith is the beginning of our awakening. In response to suffering, faith arises. And the quality of faith evolves as we practice. The first stage of faith is sometimes called bright faith. It's like something awakens our spiritual consciousness. There are all kinds of stories in the suttas of people seeing the Buddha, seeing this person, just walking or just standing, but there was something about him that triggered something, that awakened something just by being in his presence or seeing his presence. Some kind of recognition. One of my Japanese teachers in Japan tells this story of when he was, I think he was quite young, maybe 16 or 17, he was on a city bus in Kyoto, and he saw a man who's an old man with a long beard, quietly reading a book on the bus. It's like, okay. And he said, there's something about this man that was just, he was just mesmerized by him. And he was wearing a kind of a monk's work clothes. So he could have been a monk or he could have been, a worker. Or something. But he said, there was something about this person that just so drew him that when this person got off the bus, my teacher, this Harada Roshi, followed him. And so he followed him, for a while to the gates of this temple. And he followed him into the temple. And he ended up becoming that man's student. And that man was Yamada Mumon Roshi, who is considered one of the greatest Zen masters of Japan in the 20th century. And so when I think of bright faith, I think of the story of, something captures our heart. And so this bright faith is something that brings us to practice, but it's considered not necessarily so reliable, because it doesn't have so much wisdom. It can be fickle. You can have, I remember when I first started practicing and I would go to listen to one teacher and I was like, wow, that teacher is really great. They really have it. And then the next week I go to listen to another teacher and I'm like, wow, she's pretty good too. Or he's, and you kind of, so it could be a little bit of like an infatuation, a bright faith. So as we practice, bright faith evolves into verified faith. So like I said before, in the beginnings of practice, it can feel a little bit like we're stumbling along in the dark. You know, but as we practice and we begin to see some of the fruits of the practice, we begin to see some, you know, some increased calm, some more mindfulness. Some ability to stay with a difficult emotion instead of just, you know, immediately lashing out, you know, projecting it out. So we start to get a little bit of confidence, and it's like, okay, there's something here. I remember when I was kind of early in my practice, and I used to have a lot of, when I was younger, much younger, in my teens, I would have a lot of problems falling asleep because I would always be thinking, so much thinking. And I started doing the practice, and then I remember just noticing that I was laying in bed, and all that was in my mind was just the sensation of the head on the pillow. And there was just this real peaceful quality without all the chatter that I was accustomed to. And I thought, oh, interesting. So we start to get more confidence, and we start to, something becomes verified. The more confidence we have, this becomes motivating, and it's kind of like a positive feedback loop. So it's said that verified faith becomes polished and strengthened by doubt. And it said there are two kinds of doubt. It's like the kind of doubt that's helpful is the kind of doubt that is this feeling of not taking someone else's word for something. It's like, I want to find out for myself. I want to know for myself whether this is true. And in this practice, that kind of doubt is very, very helpful. As the Buddha says in the Kalama Sutta, put this into practice and find out for yourself. Trust your own experience rather than what other people say or what you've read, etc. So that's one kind of doubt. The kind of doubt that is more of a hindrance is the kind of skeptical doubt of that, that voice, that can sometimes, be whispering, you can't do this, this place isn't really, there's a better center or something. Or who's this guy? Where's Gil? That kind of doubt, if it's left unchecked, can be paralyzing. It can be demoralizing. And one of the reasons that it's so, I would say it's insidious, is because it can be so convincing. Doubt is considered the hindrance that's the most difficult to see, because it's, just operating in the background. And, can be very convincing. So it's said to overcome doubt, it is essential to see it clearly. I remember when I was on one retreat and I was doing concentration practices. Something came up that was difficult, and it was just having a lot of negative, a lot of fear, a lot of just negative experiences. And it was about 2 weeks into a 4-week retreat, and I went to my teacher, the teacher I was interviewing with, who was Carol Wilson, Some of you might know her. And I said, you know, I just don't think this is a good idea for me, and I don't think I should do this. And this, and she just looked at me and she said, doubt. And I said, oh, that's how you do it. It's like, oh, okay. And so it can be very helpful when someone else points out your doubt. Noting doubt can also be very helpful. You know, it creates some distance from the doubting thoughts. And it's said that the antidote to doubt is developing this kind of faith, developing this faith, this developing this trust in oneself, in the Dharma, in the practice. So along with doubt, fear is also a big hindrance. You know, many of the maps of meditation describe the explicit stages of fear that we go through on the path. And those are stages where the fear actually predominates. And one way or another, we have to pass through them. So this is just to say that when fear arises, you know, over the course of meditation, it's not a mistake. It's like, you know, fear shows us where our edge is. I often think of, you know, in my own practice and when talking to other people, it's like, you know, when fear comes up, it's like, great. Because this is it's like a sign that we're going deeper, that we're kind of, you know, at our growing edge. So when fear is very strong, something about letting faith, something about letting trust be, trust in the Dharma, trust in this practice, be our refuge. Faith in mindfulness itself. It's like the awareness, the mindfulness that knows the fear is itself not afraid. And that's something that can be helpful, that taking refuge in. So I think of one interesting question is, what do you trust? You know, what do you depend on? I think for many of us, usually what we trust is our thinking, our thoughts. You know, and it makes sense in a way because, you know, that's how we navigate the world. However, a kind of compulsive thinking is often kind of the mind's attempt to control life, you know, to project itself onto reality. And in its less extreme forms, you know, I know this for myself, this always sense of trying to tinker, you know, especially in meditation, trying to tinker, trying to improve some form of doing. So what's been most meaningful to me as an expression of faith and trust is this ability to leave myself alone. It's like if you have a glass of water that's cloudy, you know, the more you kind of move it and stir it up, it's like the cloudier it gets. The only way to the only way to clear that water is to just leave it, you know, just let something settle. I think for, that has been one of my big learnings, not only from Vipassana, but also from Zen, where there's not much instruction given. And it's like, you basically just learn to leave yourself alone and not add that second arrow, that arrow of, you know, reactivity. Not to add the suffering of reactivity, of resistance. So something about that, something about non-doing, something about leaving ourselves alone, it takes a lot of trust, it takes a lot of faith. Cherishing ourselves as we are. And then the movement on the path in this practice is towards a maturing, a maturation of faith, which is sometimes called abiding faith or unshakable faith. You know, so this is like, you know, when we've seen something for ourselves, when we know something for ourselves, that's something that no one can take away from us. That's something that no one can convince us otherwise. So in a way, it's like faith becomes knowing. Faith becomes knowledge. Faith becomes wisdom. And in this practice, in the meditation, it's like we go in closely, we zoom in to see exactly what's happening, to see exactly the nature of what is, and then we find it everywhere. And I think about it as this journey of, you know, when we first come to practice, it's like the way things are is a problem. You know, how things are is a problem. And then the journey and the shift is seeing that the way things are is the answer. It's like, you know, this very mind, exactly as it is Buddha. You know, so it's like we take a leap into the unknown and discover this simplicity of being, this complete simplicity of being. And this is the kind of ultimate faith or trust, which is faith that has no object. You know, it's not faith in something. Usually the way our mind works, the way our consciousness works is always about something. There's always some object. You know. But the faith which has no object, doesn't depend on anything. In the suttas, this is called abiding independent. Asakni Rinpoche says, to be happy for no reason. And I always like that. And Suzuki Roshi says, just to be alive is enough. So maybe that's enough for now. Thank you very much.